Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Missile strikes on hospitals in Gaza, with healthcare there already at a breaking point.
The healthcare system has been targeted since the beginning of the war. We have accepted the risk.
Medical professionals remain in Gaza despite the danger. I'm Marco Werman. Also, a landmark meeting between the leaders of Syria and the U.S. and extreme heat in India.
We are biologically built and psychologically trained to deal with the daytime heat.
Nighttime heat? That's another story. And a global clothing giant using AI fashion models, but there's a catch. The real models for those models are still getting paid. Plus, he was known as the world's poorest president.
Everything was very, very plain, and it was not an act.
Remembering Uruguay's Jose Mujica, all that and more today here on The World. This is The World. Carolyn Beeler is away. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for tuning in today. For the first time in 25 years, an American president has met face-to-face with a leader of Syria. President Trump spent more than half an hour today with Ahmed al-Sharaa and later called Syria's transitional president a real leader with, quote, a real shot at holding it together. The meeting could mark a turning point for Syria. The World's Matthew Bell explains.
After President Trump announced that U.S. sanctions against Syria would be lifted, Syrians and cities across the country went out into the streets to celebrate. Nada Shaheen in Homs told the Associated Press that this feels like a second liberation, referring to the fall of the Assad regime. The sanctions will be lifted, she said. A revival is coming. President Trump says he made the decision to lift sanctions on Syria after speaking with the leaders of Saudi Arabia and Turkey. Speaking earlier today in the Saudi capital, Trump said the sanctions were very powerful and that removing them will give Syria a chance for a fresh start.
We are currently exploring normalizing relations with Syria's new government, as you know, beginning with my meeting with President Ahmed al-Sharaa and Secretary Rubio's meeting with the Syrian foreign minister in Turkey.
It's hard to overstate how far Washington's views on Syria have changed. This is a country that's been on the State Department's list of terrorism sponsors since 1979. After meeting with Ahmed al-Sharaa today, Trump described him as a young, attractive guy with a very strong past. Sharaa led the rebels who finally brought down the dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. At one time, he was the leader of a group that was affiliated with al-Qaeda. But times have changed. Dana Stroll is with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. She says the Gulf states that Trump is meeting with this week see Syria's president as someone who could bring stability to his country and the region.
In the past couple weeks, the government of Saudi Arabia announced that they would settle all of the outstanding debt of Syria that Bashar al-Assad owes the international financial institutions. The Qatari government announced that they would be paying the salaries of civil servants. All of this is going to give some breathing space to Mr. al-Sharaa in Damascus.
The meeting with Trump is a huge win for Syria's president and for the Gulf states that support him. But it will be seen differently by Israel, which is conducting airstrikes inside Syria and has taken control of parts of Syrian territory across the border from northern Israel. Dana Stroll says this presents a potentially dangerous situation for the United States.
A NATO ally of the United States, Turkey, has aligned itself with the al-Sharaa government and is working and in support of Damascus to consolidate security control over Syria at the very moment when another U.S. ally, Israel, is taking actions that would weaken and undermine the authority of the government in Damascus.
A miscalculation, Stroll says, could lead to a situation where everyone loses. Suzanne Maloney of the Brookings Institution says the U.S. has moved slowly and carefully on engaging with Syria's new government, and that's for good reason. But this moment, she says, also holds potential promise.
This is a sort of rare opportunity for a positive transition in the Middle East, one that I think no one really contemplated was possible until fairly recently. And it does seem that there is more that the United States and the West can do. And it's certainly going to be a place, I think, where the Saudis, the Qataris, and the Emiratis see a fairly significant role for their own diplomacy as well as their own engagement economically.
President Trump landed in Doha today and met with Qatar's emir. Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani said he and Trump are taking their partnership to another level. The emir also said he's got high hopes for the president's diplomatic efforts with Iran and for ending the war in Gaza. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell.
Right now, in Gaza, hospitals can't guarantee safety for patients or healthcare workers. That was crystal clear yesterday when Israeli missiles slammed into the Nasser Medical Complex in southern Gaza. The strike targeted a surgical ward and killed two patients. Dr. Ed Brown is a volunteer surgeon with the group Medical Aid for Palestinians. He was just one floor above during the strike.
When I visited the ward in the morning, I saw a scene of total destruction.
The situation got more dire on Tuesday when missiles struck the courtyard of the Gaza European Hospital, bringing more patients and more casualties. Brown worries that the daily violence has desensitized people.
It's difficult to know what's more shocking, that the fact that hospitals, places of safety, are being deliberately targeted, or the fact that people are so accustomed to seemingly random acts of violence and killing that people barely bat an eyelid. This is just expected. So what happens here?
A harrowing situation indeed. Amand Bazarol gave us an update today. She's an emergency coordinator for Doctors Without Borders. She was in Gaza last week.
It's more and more difficult every day. In the northern Gaza, most of the hospitals have been destroyed. There's definitely not enough capacity for inpatients, considering the pace of the war and the number of casualties that we are seeing every day. It's getting more and more difficult to cope. And with the blockade, the lack of drugs is starting to be very difficult now to be able to care for the patients.
Yeah, so talk about the supplies. What kind of supplies are lacking in the facilities where your team is still able to work?
We're trading between organizations, give me your paracetamol and I'm going to give you some gauze. It's an organization, a cooperation between all the different services, facilities, the Ministry of Health, WHO, all of us. We're trying to support each other to keep most of the facilities up and running. But again, it's not going to last very long. We're already facing a lot of shortages. And then day by day, some of the facilities we have to stop functioning. Because without drugs, you cannot treat your patients.
Well, I was wondering, just as an illustration of the deprivation, are a lot of patients being operated on without anesthesia?
Unfortunately, we're not there yet, but that means more that you're going to follow the patient for the wound care. You will not have the anesthetic that they need to be able to change their dressing. So operation we manage still, but there's people that are very much in pain because you need to change the dressing very often. And even more, because of the lack of food, the people are not healing. Somebody would take normally 1 week and then you will stop doing dressing for them. They stay with us for 2 to 3 weeks. And then you still need to change their dressing all the time because of the lack of decent food. And I'm not even talking about decent food. I'm just talking about food itself.
Mm. I've heard medical professionals describe the frustration around getting supplies that are so desperately needed and are only just miles away across the border but can't get in. Is that still the situation?
It's absolutely the situation at the moment. There's tons of food, tons of aid, the drugs that we desperately needed to treat all those patients that are just across the border. And it's so frustrating for all of us knowing that we could care for those patients, knowing also that most of them are here because of the situation, because of the war, but not only because they are hungry, because they are starving. And then we are seeing patients that could be prevented just by opening the border.
How many hospitals and clinics are up and running in Gaza, and where exactly are they?
I'm going to talk about only hospital because I don't have the full picture for primary health care. But we're talking about 16 hospitals that are still running partially. All of them have been targeted at some point and have lost some of their capacities. So all of them are only partially functioning. Nasser, that you just spoke about, has been hit twice in the last months. There's Al Ahli Hospital, the emergency department, has been targeted as well. So, especially in the north, we are losing some capacity. Like most of the main hospitals have been destroyed during the war. And now, like we are trying to build some field hospital, but operating under tents today, like it's so dangerous. Like it's very difficult to take that kind of decisions.
As I said earlier, you were just in Gaza. What are some of the images and stories from your most recent visit that just still replay in your mind?
People queuing every day, queuing to try to see if there's some small kitchen that's going to distribute a little bit of food, queuing to try to find some water, and then like the women trying to collect the rubbish to be able to do some fire at home, to be able to cook the very little that they found, women trying to find some herbs to cook them because there's nothing left. And even if there were a few cans available, it's absolutely way too expensive for anyone to afford them. So it's really the daily life, the basic needs of the people that are not met today.
I'm wondering, do this week's strikes on hospitals in Gaza change the picture there in a significant way that we should all be recognizing and understanding right now? It's kind of hard to gauge just like how drastic it goes from day to day in Gaza.
We're working there. We're working in Nasser, and we're really worried every day when we go to work. I'm very worried every morning when I send the bus with all the staff in there, like of what's going to happen to them. But unfortunately, it's not new. The healthcare system has been targeted since the beginning of the war, and we have accepted that. It's terrible to say, but we have accepted the risk. We have accepted all of us, the Palestinian staff and the international workers that are going there as well. We have accepted that we are at risk even when we are in a facility that should be protected.
How do you communicate the urgency of that everyday dire situation to the outside world?
So first, we communicate with the Israelis every single day. We're explaining the situation. We're explaining how dire is the situation and how it's important to open the border. And that's on a daily basis coming from all the humanitarian community. And then we're reaching out to the different governments, all of us. We are trying, if I'm French, I'm going to be able to try to discuss with my own government and trying to find some people to listen to us. And it's been 19 months of that war with people who are dying every single day. And the response of the international community is not at the level as it should be. We should have stopped that war since a very long time. We should have had the ceasefire. We should have had the hostages released since a long time already.
I asked you earlier about some of the images and stories from your most recent visit. I wonder if there's a person that you are thinking about whose story has really impacted you.
Honestly, there are so many, and especially the children. We are running a burn unit in Gaza, so we are especially in burns, and we are seeing those patients. The little children, some of them, they lost all their family members during a strike, and now we're taking care of them, but we can see that it's very difficult. They're in pain all day long. We are trying to find some families to care for them once they will be able to leave the hospital. And it's terrible to see how many of those children we have seen since the beginning of the war in our world. It's unbelievable, and it's heartbreaking every day to go to the hospital and see the number of children that are unfortunately the collateral damage of that war.
Amon Bazerol is an emergency coordinator for Doctors Without Borders. The headline kind of writes itself: Pope meets sinner. In this case, Jannik Sinner, the top-ranked Italian tennis player. Sinner took a break from the Italian Open to meet Pope Leo XIV today. The new pope is an avid tennis fan, but he joked earlier this week that he can't invite a sinner to the Vatican. The sinner is an obvious exception. Jannik Sinner brought two rackets and a ball with him to the reception room of the Vatican's auditorium. Leo reportedly scanned the antiques in the room and said a little volley was probably not a great idea. Looking at a smiley picture of the two of them at the Vatican, even without that volley, let's just say the score was love, love. Sinner has a quarterfinal match at the Italian Open tomorrow. Pope Leo has something better: honorary membership in the Italian Tennis and Paddle Federation. You're listening to The World.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Germany is a republic, not a monarchy. But this week, police cracked down on an extremist group called the Kingdom of Germany and took the self-proclaimed king and three of his so-called subjects into custody. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more.
Peter Fitzek crowned himself king on September 16, 2012. Dressed in red and white fur robes, standing on a stage in the small German town of Wittenberg, Fitzek announced the formation of a brand new state.
Von dem Willen des Flügel, dem Schöpfer, den Menschen, dem Frieden und dem Fortschritt in der Welt zu dienen.
Inspired by the will to serve the Creator, the people, peace and progress in the world, he said, we, the free men and women, are creating a new German state. Fitzek, who wears his long black hair slicked back in a tight ponytail, was a former chef.
He had a new age store and he sold pans and he was a cook and he was very embedded into the extreme right.
Tobias Ginsburg is an investigative journalist in Germany.
And then at some point he had this great idea, well, I can make much more money and gain much more power if I use conspiracy theories.
Ginsburg knows about the Kingdom of Germany and its king better than most. He infiltrated the group for 9 months back in 2017.
I always try to lie as little as possible when I'm going undercover. So, of course, I shouldn't tell them that I'm Jewish. But I told them all the problems I have with society, I made a little bit more angry.
Ginsburg says many of the people he met back then had fallen on rough times. The kingdom was like a cult that offered them refuge, he says. German authorities say the group doesn't appear to pose a violent threat to the state, but it is affiliated with the broader Reichsbürger movement. That's a network of groups in Germany that promotes a range of far-right conspiracy theories and refuses to recognise the current German state.
And if you talk to neo-Nazis, like old-school neo-Nazis, of course they will tell you that the Federal Republic is not the real Germany and we have to get Germany back and we have to fight for that.
The kingdom has its own currency and healthcare system. It tells its members not to use conventional medicine. Felix Neumann, an expert in far-right extremism in Berlin, says the movement also appeals to those who've lost faith in democracy. And its leaders, he says, are masters at self-promotion.
They have very professional accounts on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter, but also on Telegram, where they produce very good videos of their lifestyle, of their ideas, and that attracts a lot of people.
Neumann says groups like the Kingdom of Germany used to be seen as oddballs, but that changed in recent years, particularly after police foiled an attempt by another Reichsbürger group to stage a violent coup in 2022. Rolf Frankenberger, an extremism expert at Tübingen University, says kingdom members can also cause serious headaches for the local authorities.
They flood public institutions with ridiculous requests and demands and sometimes also threaten public employees. So things that are aiming at disabling public administrations to work.
This week, German police said Peter Fitzek, the man who calls himself king, is being investigated for leading a criminal organisation and illegally selling insurance and investments. Journalist Tobias Ginsburg says the state's decision to ban the group isn't a bad thing, but it may not have the desired effect.
When I went on my research on this topic back then, that was in 2017, 2018, I met people who are now sitting in the German parliament. People who know what they can say openly and when they should be quiet.
Putting one man and his three subjects behind bars, Ginsburg says, is unlikely to put a stop to the spread of conspiracy theories and hate. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Cuba was once known as the sugar bowl of the world, but raw sugar production in Cuba is in trouble. This year, the yield will drop to only 20% of what it's been recently. The decline of sugar in Cuba has been long and complicated, as Michael Bustamante explains. He's the director of Cuban Studies at the University of Miami.
You'd have to go back to the 19th century to find total sugar output numbers this low. The decline is not sudden and hasn't happened overnight. The sugar industry in Cuba has been sort of on a terminal decline for a number of years now, but the pace of that decline has just accelerated, particularly since the pandemic.
I mean, Cuba has long relied on sugar economically. Can you just take us back to the beginning? How and when did all of this come about?
You know, the sugar production was present in Cuba from pretty early on in the process of Spanish colonization, began picking up steam in the late 18th century. But it's really at the turn of the 19th where sugar production kind of goes to a new degree, right, in the wake of the Haitian Revolution. Prior to that point, the French colony of Saint-Domingue had been the largest, richest, most brutal sugar colony in the world on the backs of enslaved Africans. When the Haitian Revolution happens and enslaved Africans rise up, that creates a spot in the market for Cuban sugar producers to come in. And the 19th century saw the Cuban sugar industry just grow and grow and grow and increasingly become more dependent on its relationship with the United States.
Right. Fast forward to 1959 and the revolution that brought Fidel Castro to power. The economic dependency in Cuba on sugar continued. Why was that?
Well, it wasn't supposed to. I mean, one of the sort of Achilles heels of the Cuban economy after Cuba becomes independent in 1902 was precisely its dependence on sugar exports to the U.S. market. Reformists forever had been talking about the need to diversify the economy. When the Cuban Revolution comes to power, that's what they set about doing. But eventually, they had to sort of double down on sugar monoculture. Why? Because U.S. sanctions sort of forced them to have a close relationship with the Soviet Union. And what the Soviet Union was offering was, we'll buy a ton of your sugar at subsidized prices, in fact, above world market prices, and will ship to you in exchange hard machinery. So the sugar dependence was just, you know, continued in many ways.
I mean, that was an economic path that benefited both countries. What started the decline in sugar production in recent decades?
Well, the fall of the Soviet Union, for starters, right?
Right.
But I think as you sort of move into the 1990s and in 2000s, they decide to resize the industry. They close sugar mills. The Cuban government is investing more capital in tourism, seeing that as sort of their export industry of the future. In 2000, I think it was 11, they got rid of the Ministry of Sugar, which that tells you something of how important it was. So there's been a kind of a progressive gutting out of the infrastructure for sugar production. And there hasn't been capital to reinvest and need a new equipment. I mean, these facilities are really, really old. And so that also kind of contributed to the decline.
So, Michael, what's your thinking? Is the Cuban government going to let sugar production die out, or do you see efforts to save it there?
I don't really see a plan in place now to sort of reinvigorate the industry. I mean, unless the Cuban government, you know, wants to try to sort of open it up to foreign capital to a degree that they've not been willing to in the past. Sugar production remains very important, if nothing else, because it also contributes to other major Cuban exports. Think of rum, right? Rum is made from sugar. The idea now that, you know, Cuba is having to import sugar from other parts of the world to just supply its domestic population with sugar for their kitchen tables, but also for the production of rum, I mean, that's a sort of a devastating irony.
I mean, sugar has become such an icon of Cuba. I mean, it's a calling card of the country's great singer, Celia Cruz, Azúcar. I mean, how significant is this moment in the culture and identity of Cubans?
I think it speaks to just a wider sense of crisis, a crisis that's political, it's economic, it's about the legitimacy of the state. You're seeing it in out-migration, not to sound too dismal, but a real utter lack of hope, I think, in most corners of Cuban society. So it's really difficult to sort of identify what the pathway out is going to be.
Michael Bustamante is the director of Cuban Studies at the University of Miami. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Imagine, if you can, an American president opting not to move into the White House, instead presiding over duties of state from a farmhouse. No chauffeured armored limousine, rather a 1987 VW Beetle that he drives himself. That essentially describes how the president of Uruguay lived between 2010 and 2015. José Mojica was legendary, not just in Uruguay, but worldwide, for his unique qualities as a head of state. Following yesterday's news of Mojica's death at the age of 89, we wanted to take a moment to remember his improbable path to the presidency. Pablo Broom wrote a book about Mojica's life called The Robin Hood Guerrillas.
Mojica's life starts in rural Uruguay, which is a small country, but imagine a small town is a small country, right? He lost his father at the age of 6, his mother sold, you know, flowers at local markets. So a very modest upbringing. So he was a boy, actually, who had to work from a young age. and was like a person with street savvy, if you will, from a very early age.
I mean, in his younger years, he got involved in a leftist guerrilla movement. What started him down that path? Like, how old was he?
Right. So Mujica was part of a movement brimming with youth, but he himself was above the age of 30 when he joined. So within the group, he was kind of one of the veterans in the sense of older age, right? So he was kind of radicalized, to use a word we use now, by the Cuban Revolution. For people like Mujica, it was a choice between formal communist parties aligned with the Soviet Union or China or Cuba, or a movement that is also Marxist, maybe communist, but is independent of those global powers. And that is what the Tupamaros, the group that he belonged to, was.
Was there any violence committed by the Tupamaro movement, and was Mujica involved in any of it?
Yes. So there was extensive violence, more than a decade of violence in terms of breadth. They were not a brutal group in the way that we're more used to terrorist movements in more recent years in other regions of the world. But yes, they did kill people, both members of the security services, policemen, soldiers, but also some civilians, some by accident, some by execution. And Mujica himself was involved in shootouts. He was injured and captured. There is no indication that he actually killed anyone, either from his own remarks or from accusations by others. But he never reneged on this notion that he gave orders, he carried the weapon and fired it, indisputably by all parties, in this conflict, if you will.
Mm. So Mujica was imprisoned after that. How did his experience in detention shape him? And was that what pushed him into politics?
From the minute he gets out of prison, Mujica is no longer this radical, would-be revolutionary, obsessed with typical classic Marxist revolutionary beliefs. He came out this hardened skeptic in the sense of saying revolution is actually something you have to do day by day, person by person, lesson by lesson in terms of education, rather than massive political banners and marches and movements and all of that. He was the main person doing that, hence his success in Uruguay with the disadvantaged and people who were predisposed maybe to progressive politics, but many others who were not engaged in politics at all.
I mean, with his history with the Tupamaro movement, I mean, that's got to be something of a tough sell. Can you take us back to that campaign, that presidential campaign, and what was a case Mujica made to the people of Uruguay that he should be president?
It's almost as if he had never been a Tupamaro. They either forgave it or they didn't even know much about it. Now, the other half of the population that did not vote for him would definitely have told you that that was one of their core objections. To this day, on election night, one of the things he said was, "It took me my entire life to learn that the power comes from the people and not elites, politicians, movements, parties, etc."
So what were some of the trappings of presidential status and power that he rejected that kind of brought this new approach?
There was a standard. You know, the president is dressed in a suit and tie, speaks in a certain way, is accessible and not accessible in certain ways.
Mm.
But nothing like what Mujica did, which was absolutely, in that sense, it was revolutionary. I don't think any world leader has matched that. He flew coach. He donated his salary. The place where he lived in, where every journalist in the world pretty much was there. It was cramped. It was dark. It was humid. No air conditioner. Everything was very, very plain. And it was not an act. When asked about it, he would say, "Yeah, everybody celebrates my lifestyle, but nobody follows my lead. I don't see anybody else in politics, local or global, that kind of would try to emulate this, which is that politicians should live the way that the majority of people live."
Pablo Broom is an adjunct at the Georgetown Security Studies Program. His book is The Robin Hood Guerrillas, The Epic Journey of Uruguay's Tupamaros. Our thoughts go out to people across Texas this week as they deal with potentially record-breaking heat. In India, experts say climate change is driving early heat for a second year in a row. Last year, extreme heat between March and July caused 374 deaths and more than 80,000 suspected cases of heat stroke. This year, high nighttime temperatures in particular pose a serious health risk. Reporter Sushmita Pathak visited an informal settlement on the edge of Delhi to find out how people are coping.
It's dark outside, but Marina Yasmin's one-room home feels like a hot box. She lives in a dusty lot full of shacks made of tin sheets, The walls inside her home are covered with a bed sheet. The tin sheets heat up during the day, she says. The bed sheet is to protect us from the hot surface. There are no windows in our home, no refrigerator. The only source of relief is what's called a desert cooler that Yasmin borrowed from a neighbor. The device has a fan and a water tank and cools the air by evaporating water. But even this relief is unreliable. Power cuts are frequent here, says Yasmin's aunt Regina Begum. Sometimes there's no electricity for 3 or 4 hours a night. We work all day and then don't even get to sleep at night. It gets so unbearably hot that people are forced out of their homes in the middle of the night, she says. Scorching daytime heat dominates headlines and public health discussions in India. But rising night temperatures are not getting enough attention, says Sumedha Malviya, a clean energy expert with the World Resources Institute India.
It's sort of a blind spot as far as our understanding of heat is concerned.
During a heat wave, being outdoors during the day can be deadly. Advisories urge people to stay indoors where it's cooler. But at night, it's often the opposite.
Even if the temperature outside comes down, the housing itself absorbs the heat in the day and then it doesn't cool down at night. And so the temperature is remaining essentially constant throughout the day and night.
Caroline Bucky is an epidemiologist at Harvard University. She's studying the effect of extreme heat on India's working poor, who live in dense urban areas like the one I visited. For women, that also means cooking in hot environments with little ventilation.
We're really starting to reach the temperatures and humidity levels that we associate with potential and unlivable situation.
India has always been very hot, but this kind of heat is not normal, says Avikal Somvanshi, who has studied heat stress in urban India.
So climate change is actually fueling the heat waves.
Climate change has made heat waves longer and more frequent, he says, and there's no going back.
Heat waves have already become quite stable. They are coming every year in a certain pattern. The climate has already changed enough for these to become a new normal.
Last June, Delhi recorded its hottest night in over 50 years with a low of 95 degrees. Across India, nighttime temperatures are higher than they were 15 years ago. That's according to a 2024 analysis by Somvanshi when he was at the Center for Science and Environment in Delhi.
Especially the cities, the temperature is not dropping at night.
Cities tend to be hotter than their surrounding rural areas even in the day because of the way they're built. The concrete urban environment traps and radiates heat, and there's less green cover to offset it. But to Somvanshi's surprise, even greener parts of Delhi are seeing elevated nighttime temperatures.
Having tree cover can help you get shade during the daytime temperature, but it seems to be totally ineffective in cooling down things at night.
Trying to sleep in warm temperatures is not only uncomfortable, but can also be dangerous. Studies have shown that there's a link between warm nights and increased mortality.
We are biologically built and psychologically trained to deal with the morning heat, daytime heat. But we need certain temperature conditions for body to recoup and rest and repair whatever damages has happened.
Not getting a chance to recover makes the body more susceptible to heat-related illness, Somvanshi says. The whirring noise of coolers in Marina Yasmin's neighborhood nearly drowns out the squeals of children playing nearby. Many women told me the kids aren't able to tolerate the heat. My 5-year-old gets covered in heat rashes, Yasmin says. I have to bathe her 2 to 3 times a day. The little girl keeps asking for ice cream all day.
The challenge really is about thermal comfort, right? And there you actually interestingly see two Indias emerging.
Those who can afford air conditioning and those who cannot, says clean energy expert Sumedha Malviya. A new report from the India Energy and Climate Center at the University of California, Berkeley, estimates that India will add up to 150 million room air conditioners in the next decade, driven by rising incomes and rising temperatures. It's a vicious cycle because ACs contribute to climate change and also pump hot air outside.
that sort of warms up the entire neighborhood, which also has these communities which don't have access to ACs. So it's creating this big pooling divide.
This divide is something Marina Yasmin is familiar with. She works as a domestic helper. The families she works for have air conditioning. But after washing their dishes and mopping their floors all day, she can't even catch some rest because of the heat in her own home. Sometimes I don't feel like I am a human being, she says. She looks forward to going to work these days. It's her only escape from the heat. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak, Delhi.
In Libya, clashes between rival militias broke out on Monday in the capital, Tripoli, leading to some of the worst violence the city has seen in years. So far, no official death toll, but a ceasefire was announced today. The situation remains unstable, as it has for the past 15 years, ever since rebels toppled dictator Muammar Gaddafi during the Arab Spring. Now running Libya are two de facto rival governments. Tarek Megharissi is a senior policy fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. He described the recent events in Tripoli.
It's been a hectic 2 days of fighting that was started by a kind of gangland-style assassination committed by the troops belonging to the Ministry of Defense under the Prime Minister of the Government of National Unity. They had summoned a man named Abdel Ghani al-Kikli, who was the kingpin of Tripoli, the most powerful militia leader. And they summoned him for a meeting. And shortly afterwards, he ended up dead, likely due to an assassination. And this was the start of a consolidation attempt by the Government of National Unity to push out some of these other groups over which they didn't have control. But as these things tend to do in Libya, it all went horribly wrong. And it's devolved into 2 days of heavy fighting now, including the use of drones and artillery and anti-aircraft cannons, all in very dense urban areas.
And that militia leader who was allegedly assassinated, was he a part of the rival government in Benghazi? What do we know about who he was?
He didn't have any government affiliations, although he was very closely aligned with the military leader Khalifa Haftar, who kind of de facto runs that rival government in eastern Libya. The situation in Libya, you know, since the last 4 years especially, has really broken down into something that the UN themselves described in a recent report as an unprecedented degree of state capture by armed groups. And he was the guy who exemplified that. You know, him and his guys, they had control over the Central Bank of Libya. They had control over the government's internal security agency, almost like the secret police. So he was really kind of just widespread throughout very lucrative government areas, and he kept ties with both governments in order to maintain his business.
So why is it that so many years after the 2011 revolution, these militias are still so powerful in Tripoli?
It's a heady cocktail of kind of the economic opportunity that comes, the inability for any side to clearly win, and international interventionism, which always seeks to patronize one of these groups. And so, you know, these militias, they have amassed billions of dollars over the last few years. So they have a very powerful position, and their businesses are employing a lot of people, and there's a kind of trickle-down patronage network almost that supports them. The shadow economy in Libya has been going on for so long and has become so strong that really it's cannibalized the normal economy, which is why these guys are so settled in their position right now.
So what would the Libyan people like to see?
Oh, the Libyan people have been clear in all the ways that they can express that they would love to get rid of both governments and both parliaments in the country as well, and just move on from this system that was put in place in 2014 to move towards a new constitutional order, to move towards a unified government that can oversee the country, and to move towards a unification process that brings all of these different armed groups together under civilian control in terms of a real police force and a real army and so on and so forth. They want to see a return to order. Unfortunately, the UN, which promised to give them that after the last civil war in 2020, has been unable to see through such a process. So there have been protests from time to time, but unfortunately, the people themselves are powerless to change things and are increasingly nihilistic as a result.
So where is the daylight, Tariq? Where do you see the potential for unification going forward between these two rival governments in Tripoli and Benghazi?
Well, my hope is that after a display of violence like we've seen last night, there is a realization that the status quo that has existed since 2021 is simply untenable, and we cannot continue as we are. There is a new special envoy of the UN, Hannah Tete, the former foreign minister of Ghana, who is a strong personality in her own right. There is more international attention on Libya than there has been for the past few years. So hopefully this moment and the kind of crisis that it's created can be used as momentum towards a new political process for Libya, which can hopefully come off the back of a mediation process now to end this current round of fighting.
Tariq Megharissi is Senior Policy Fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Artificial intelligence has taken nearly every industry by storm. Take the global fashion world. Swedish retail giant H&M recently announced it's creating AI-generated clones of fashion models. Digital doppelgangers, but with a twist. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more on that.
H&M is creating virtual versions of the models they work with in their big marketing campaigns. The plan is to use these digital twins in social media ads and marketing materials. H&M isn't the first brand to try something like this. In 2023, Levi's tried to use virtual models. They signed a deal with an AI studio and said the technology would let them show their clothes on a whole range of models with different skin tones and body types. It was a PR disaster.
Now, Levi's, what is this? Y'all can't be serious.
They'd rather make a fake person of color wear their clothes than pay a real person of color.
In 2024, Mango used AI models in ad campaigns. They were accused of false advertising and stealing human jobs. So H&M is going about this differently. They got 30 models into a motion capture studio where dozens of cameras took pictures of them from all different angles, doing all sorts of poses. So they ended up with a detailed 3D scan that captures everything right down to their birthmarks. What's truly unique in this arrangement is that the model owns the rights and she can license out her digital twin to H&M or other companies for a fee. So the model could, in theory, walk the runway in Milan while her digital doppelganger poses in a denim ad in Dubai, or computer-generated Dubai.
They're trying to do things the right way, or that's how they're presenting it.
Bryant Merchant is the author of Blood in the Machine. He covers AI and its impact on creative industries.
The big complaint about AI in the workplace is that AI is often used without consent and without providing compensation. At least H&M is trying to pay models for that work.
In L.A., where he lives, movie, TV, and video game actors have gone on strike over concerns about consent and compensation for AI replicas. Luca Arrigo says AI can't be stopped and no one's served by trying to ignore it. He runs an AI fashion startup called Better Studio that makes AI models for clothing websites.
I've been working closely with a lot of fashion brands to actually get their clothing on top of these artificially generated models. So over the last 2 years, this technology has been improving quite quickly. And over the last 3 to 6 months, it's gotten to a point where it's almost impossible to tell whether it was AI generated or taken in a photo studio.
In June, he's launching an AI influencer marketplace where social media influencers can upload their digital twins and fashion brands can go to license them. The influencer will make money when their avatar is used.
So what we're aiming to do is we cannot eliminate deepfakes, but we can create a system where people are fairly compensated if their image is used in a campaign. Same with music, right? You couldn't stop people from sharing music online, but we can allow people to be paid per view on YouTube or Spotify.
Sounds nice, but musicians say they can't earn a living from streaming, and most of the money goes to the big streaming platforms instead of to the creators. But even if models were compensated fairly, and it's unclear what that even means, what about everyone else? Asks Bianca Petrișor. She's a fashion photographer in Romania.
Most photographers that I've talked to are very concerned that they will lose their jobs to AI.
And they're not the only ones, she says.
Obviously, in fashion photography, you need a creative team with you. So people that work with the lights is also people that work as assistants in the studios. Then we have the stylists that dress the models. We have the makeup team, the hair team. So there's a lot of people that go into the shoot.
A lot of people now scared for their livelihoods. In a statement, H&M said they don't pretend to have all the answers at this point. And they know that using digital twins will spark opinions, discussions, and uncertainty. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
There's been lots of talk about Leo XIV since he became Pope last week, but another lesser-known Leo has been making news, too. Leo the Cat. A court in Zurich has been hearing a criminal case against a woman accused of trying to make her neighbor's cat her own. The specific charge is systematic feeding, which, in case you didn't know, it's illegal in Switzerland. Feeding a neighbor's cat occasionally? Totally fine. The public broadcaster SWI Swiss Info reports that the accused installed a cat door for Leo so he could come and go from her apartment. Her efforts over 10 months created a situation where Leo didn't want to go home. The unnamed woman faces more than $5,000 in fines. If only Leo could testify on his own behalf. It's not uncommon for artists to forge their identities in the oases of underground art scenes. Just ask Sami Galbi. The musician grew up in the Swiss Alps with parents from Morocco. He says he often felt like a stranger in both countries, present but absent. Underground art communities gave him a sense of belonging. Galbi was part of an arts collective in the Swiss city of Lausanne, where he absorbed a counterculture of DJ sets and cutting-edge drag shows. Then in 2023, an arts residency took him to Morocco, and he sought out a similar vibe. First in the city of Ouarzazate, then onto Casablanca, where he came into his own as a musician. What Galbi heard in Morocco that inspired him was what he calls the sounds of his childhood, in particular the North African musical style known as Rai, a traditional sound that is dance floor ready. You can hear that influence on Galbi's debut album. It's called Yella Bye Bye. That's a common phrase across the Middle East and North Africa, meaning let's go or see you later. Fitting for an artist with a portable recording studio and always on a quest to find himself and his people. Sami Galbi there with music from his debut album, Yella Bye Bye. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Great photos and stories from our journalists are all over Instagram. You can follow us. We are at The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you, as always, for listening.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life, luminafoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation, by the Henry Luce Foundation, by the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese, LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillianne Schneider. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
from PR.